wait till they get a load of me.
Matt from Lincoln's on Thrones. I wanted to take a minute just to clarify a couple things that have come through and bubbled up through the comments. What anybody said, wrote, or thought is valid. Let me validate everything that was said, written, or thought.
You sound like Cookie Monster.
Because you said it, you wrote it, or you thought it. And that's valid. So please, let me validate that. And let me state unequivocally, I respect the fact that you said it, you wrote it, or you thought it. I respect that very much. So let me validate and respect what you said. And I apologize that I didn't spend more time validating or respecting things that Bill said. Because he said them. And they were valid.
I'm Batman.
Because he said them.
Darling, I don't have to answer to you. I'm Batman.
Or something like that.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and kind of reinvigorated, you know, like... You know how we've been really burnt out on talking about Mormon issues, and I think I'm ready to kind of dive back into some stuff. These listener essays have been really reinvigorating that way. So anyway, that's not really what today's episode is. On Patreon, we created a new category that's like a kind of a think tank to help provide some direction ideas to help steer the direction. And so I asked the other day what they want to see more of. And one of the suggestions was more PPIs like we used to do. So it's been a while since we've done PPIs. So today you're going to get part one of a PPI with Matt Long. You may remember, I think when we did his PPI before, he was still a sex crimes prosecutor for the county. And there really wasn't that much that he could say about it at the time. Maybe he had already shifted to becoming a criminal defense attorney. But today he talks about that shift. He talks about some of the changes in his life, some enlightenment, some other things that have become really meaningful for him. So with no further ado, I give you a PPI with Matt Long, part one.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
So what's going on in your world, Matt?
Nothing. Same old.
All right. Good episode.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Things have been moving fast. You know, and it's not fast. It's awakenings that I've had and transitions that I've kind of been experiencing have become a little more clear.
So, since December when we did our cultural membrane thing and you did your Jesus minisode, and I guess we did the religion, what do we call it? The religion of science or something like that. The one where Randy was just really like,
oh yeah, the TED Talk and the
yeah with the Sheldrake thing. And
that's right. Yeah. I liked that one.
Yeah,
I liked the Sheldrake stuff, and the conversation bemused me.
Yeah. So as all of this has been going on, there's been a lot of other things happening in your world.
Yeah, but and there's been, I've been identifying like a kind of a conversion almost.
Yeah.
You know, because like forever, my identity was so wrapped up in not just being a lawyer, but being a prosecutor.
Mm.
And
how long did you do that?
So I started prosecuting in 2003. Actually, my last year of law school, I got a fellowship.
Yeah,
it was a prosecutor fellowship that allowed me to do work at the city courts, work at the county attorney's office, work at the attorney general's office doing appeals, and then working at the U.S. attorney's office. So my last year of law school, I was a student attorney. Instead of going to classes, I worked kind of as an apprenticeship, almost, is what it's built in. And it was this very, you know, those of us that got it would call it a prestigious award. I mean, it was a scholarship, and it was I got paid and got to do work instead of as credit. So it was almost like triple dipping in law school. It was really pretty cool. And it was specifically meant to target people who are going to be committed to being career prosecutors. And so in many ways, in getting that, that started this identity of not just prosecutor, but career prosecutor.
That you're going to go after injustice and...
Oh, white hat and just, you know, do everything that you... And then my path in prosecution was kind of interesting in that I happened to be supervised by what, easy to say this now, but were some of the best trial attorneys and prosecutors that, you know, that at least the state, and in some cases the nation, has to offer. And I just, and they really kind of took me on as a mentor. I learned a ton, you know, got to do some really cool cases, some interesting cases. But what happened more than that is this indoctrination into this, well, cult.
Mm.
This cult of law enforcement, prosecution, you know, going after the bad guys.
Why do you call it a cult?
Well, I call it a cult now because I learned it was a cult.
Yeah, but I mean, like, how do you define that? What does that mean?
There was brainwashing.
Okay.
There was, you know, in-group, out-group. Everybody who's not in-group...
Do you know, somebody told me recently, there's like somebody that did a lot of writing and research on cults, and they came up with something that it's an acronym that's BITE.
Okay.
BITE. And it's behavior. I forget what the I is, thought, and I forget what the E is.
Boy, you're like half there.
I know. That's why I'm asking for your help. Have you?
I've never heard that.
You haven't heard anything? But as like defining characteristics of a cult. Anyway, I'll asterisk that and look into it later.
But I was very much just like the prosecutor. Like I was, you know, I started training other prosecutors how to do trial work, how to present cases, and then that led to. Really early on in my career, you know, I had these aspirations of being this, of course, this homicide prosecutor, because that's the, you know, the top rung, you know, the legal world is the perception. And early on this, my first boss was asking what I wanted to do and that. And I said, you know, I want to be a homicide attorney, of course. And she said, all right. I said, "Well, tell me why not? Why that reaction?" She said, "Homicide's pretty easy."
Let me push pause for just a second because I looked up the BITE model of cult stuff.
Hear.
So it's behavioral control, information control, thought control, emotional control, and so then for each one of these four, there's a lot more underneath them to see, but. It's interesting that you are you thinking of the legal system just in general?
No, prosecution specifically.
Oh, prosecution specifically is like a subset of the legal system.
Absolutely,
that has its own. So what if you're going to stick to this cult thing, you would say that there's certain ways that you're trained, or you know, like you said, brainwashed, that impacts your behavior, the type of information,
absolutely,
the way that you're supposed to think about things,
absolutely,
and the way that you're supposed to feel about things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Absolutely.
Interesting. Wow.
And it starts because you're so young, and you look at these, you know, older prosecutors especially, and they really, you see, this is how it's done, and they give you not just...
It's dogma. It's just dogma.
It is, Glenn. It is 100%. And then you add to that policies.
Yeah.
And rigid policies.
Sure.
That are
AKA
advancing...
AKA dogma.
But that are advancing a certain political ideology.
Right.
And so then that ideology, in order to, I think, survive mentally, is you adopt it. And not just adopt it, but say, that is my ideology as well.
Yeah.
Right? And that definitely happened. That definitely happened early. Definitely happened. But...
Of course, you're an excellent prosecutor.
Of course.
Excellent.
Dad lets me try. Dad lets me give the opening statement.
Yeah.
But this supervisor of mine said, you know, homicide's silly. I mean, it's easy. She said, it's an ag assault with a dead body.
Mm.
Half the crime's been already proven.
Mm.
Got a dead body. Who done it?
Mm.
And it's pretty easy to find out who done it, right?
Butler.
Always the butler.
Right.
Yeah, it's always a butler. Yeah. They need a, did I hear something about a Clue remake?
I don't know. Did you?
I did. And okay. It almost disappoints me because that was the one. It was like of all the board game movies that exist.
Yeah. Like
that one was done well.
I liked Chutes and Ladders, the sequel, actually. Yeah, that was pretty dang awesome. But so if you compare Clue to Murder by Death, do you have a favorite?
I don't think I've seen Murder by Death.
Oh, dude, Murder by Death is the best. Yes, that's the answer.
Okay. Oh, I love
Neil Simon, I think.
Lenny in it, man. I just...
Yeah. Michael McKean.
Michael McKean.
Yeah. Saul's brother.
And that was pre me seeing Spinal Tap. Mm. This is Spinal Tap, which I saw as an adult. I saw it probably within the last 10 years, man. I just was freaking blown away by it.
Well, we saw it together, right? When we did the Infants Retreat in Vail, we watched Spinal Track and Spinal Tap. That was the first time I ever saw it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We watched it for a Lunchtime Movie Review once.
Oh, okay.
And I was just...
Yeah.
Maybe it was good that I saw it as an adult because I appreciated it more. Otherwise.
I seem to remember that we were in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And that Spinal Tap was on. I don't know. There was some kind of a haze over me. Yeah. I don't know that I really remember much of the movie.
You were so happy being with that the rest of the infants.
I'm sure that's what it was. I was overwhelmed with happiness.
Ecstasy.
Yeah. And it wasn't ecstasy.
Harder.
I know it
that
wasn't
you
that.
Know of.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Homicide. Homicide. Yeah, ag assault with a dead body. Crime's already proven. This is what she said is, we don't need good prosecutors in homicide. The best prosecutors handle sex crimes.
Mm.
And I took that as like this.
Oh,
well, then, I'm the best.
Then I'm gonna do. Yeah,
that's right, what I must do. Yeah. You know, and so it was after that that I had I went to my first trial group, right? Because at that time you're just kind of learning some things, you're doing some low level stuff. So I go to a felony caseload, and my supervisor is a new supervisor, and she was a career sex crimes prosecutor, now a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And she took me under her wing and allowed me to start second chairing her leftover sex cases. Mm. And so as a first year prosecutor...
This is the woman that you talked about, like in our previous episodes about feminism and stuff, where you're like, I don't have to be like respectful to all women because I used to be respectful to this one.
I don't think that was my argument.
It was something like that. She was like your one black friend, kind of.
That's not true.
Yeah, like, oh, I worked for a woman.
Because I've only had female bosses for one.
I may be misremembering that then.
No, but she was so great, and she gave me so many tools, what she also did is just motivate me to be a sex crimes prosecutor. Mm. And then there were other things that just kind of happened throughout the course there that I got in contact with other attorneys who were also in that field, in that world. And I happened to end up there. So I ended up in sex crimes, but that became really, really early on in my career an aspiration. Like that will be my new identity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
For those reasons, it's difficult, it's challenging, and because I knew it was so challenging, because the reason it's challenging is homicide, you got a dead body, right? Theft of means, burglary, you've got shit with take.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Sex crime, you can't see it.
Mm.
So right off the bat, you're kind of starting from a negative. Mm. And you're starting from...
Negative meaning like a lack of...
That's right.
Evidence or a challenge to prove?
Even evidence of a crime.
Mm.
Because most people don't accept that someone saying, a crime done happened to me, mm-hmm. is enough. Crime done happened to me. Someone stole my car. Car's not here. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is nobody ever says, well, wait a minute, let's first look at you. Because you're the first suspect to know that your car's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you did it, right? Nobody does it. Everybody just starts with, of course this person is a victim of auto theft. Now let's go find where it is and who done it, right? And that can be applied to virtually every crime. Now I'm going to come back to this in a minute, some of my realizations recently.
Yeah.
But that really motivated me. And then you had the aspect of, it's kids, man.
Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't want to be the guy who takes up for kids? About that time also, I learned very early on that, like, drug crimes weren't my bag. Like, I was always considered a softie on drug crimes because I just didn't care.
Mm.
So I knew that I wanted nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it always, that was an easy way to kind of go. The other thing is, and this maybe is more a function of my insecurities, is it was an easier path to go do major crimes in sex crimes. And the reason why is because not many people wanted to do it. So I had that kind of internal ego of, I'm good enough to do it, and I'm smart enough, and doggone it.
Yeah.
No, but I'm good enough to do it, and, it's hard, and I can do it. People say it's emotionally hard, too, and I can do that, too. I can take it on. I'm strong enough to do it, too.
How much, if any, do you think, like, growing up as a Mormon, going on a missionary, mm-hmm. like doing those things that you did, played into this sense of, I want to fix the world, I want to heal the world, I want to save the world, and kind of, like, do you see any kind of savior complex stuff like that?
No, I really didn't. It was really more ego-based.
Well, isn't that the same thing?
No, because here's the thing, dude, is like, when I started law school,
yeah,
and I started being able to do, kind of get on my feet, be in court,
mm-hmm.
it was pretty clear I was different.
Mm.
And that was based on the reaction of the professors, and then when I started in my career and started doing things on my feet, I jumped a whole kind of training section that most attorneys have to go through, and it was really kind of, it was talked about a lot, and, oh, he didn't do this or he didn't do that because he's, and part of it was because of that Truman Young that I had, like, 13-some trials before I'd ever graduated law school, including, like, 4 felony jury trials, which is, I had more jury trials than most second and third year, or many second and third year attorneys at the office. So I kind of got jumped. I was treated, kind of like this.
The golden boy.
The golden boy. Yeah. And I really was. I mean, I was treated like that by the supervisor.
And you actually had hair back then that was rather golden, right?
Yeah, it was pretty golden. Yeah. It was waning at that point.
Oh, was it? Okay.
All right. I did a preemptive strike pretty soon.
Okay.
After starting. Yeah. What about preemptive strike? So I had this. I knew I was good. I knew I was just, it was natural.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really this dual ego of, these are challenging cases, and I'm really skilled, and I'm emotionally strong enough to cope with the stuff that I deal with. I'm very good at compartmentalization, I used to tell myself.
Mm.
The thing that was so funny, maybe tragic, is how naive I was. That nobody told me what that job entailed emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told me what I was about to experience. Had I been told, you're going to be forced by your job to watch a child being sexually assaulted on film, and the sounds of her crying are going to make you sob again and again and again. For years, they didn't tell me that the sound of abuse stays with you longer than other things.
Mm.
They didn't tell me that I'd have to, I knew I'd have to talk to kids. I didn't know what that would do to me. I didn't know, but I went into it, man. And I was pretty good at it. And what it gave me, and what victims and the approach to victims give prosecutors, is something to personalize the job.
Mm-hmm.
And that is both a powerful thing and a terrifying thing. Because when you give someone with power personal motivation, it can affect objectivity. And what we want in our prosecutors and what we want in our law enforcement is objectivity, I think. Now, anyway, so that happened. And I went down that path, and I was good at it, man. not only was I was not just good at it, I was so interested by the forensics behind it and the victimology that I always say, and to learn how counterintuitive these offenses are, that the things that we look at in normal crimes are just very different here, and so the approach is very different, and it requires a lot more sophistication. It requires a little more knowledge and a little more training, and it really requires to be very effective, a very strong rhetorical approach, and that's what I learned. All those things, and I'll tell you, I loved it, man. I loved working sex crimes, despite the emotional toll that it clearly took on me. So as this is happening, I'm going through my faith transition.
Did you have a sense when you would, you know, because you're a prosecutor, you're going after the people who perpetrated these crimes.
Yeah.
Is that consistent with, like, also defending the victim, or like helping the victim, healing the victim, or it's just about, and was that like a desire that you had, you know, like a really strong motivation?
So that was a motivation, and I felt very strongly that, you know, these kids have no one.
Because you would immediately empathize with these kids.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so my thought was, is if I can get a conviction,
yeah,
I can take that monster from that child's life. Oh. I can give that child
protection. The conviction will equal healing for the child, or somehow.
Somehow.
That. You'd say that'll make it all better.
That's what this child needs.
Mm.
Because here's how I said, not only, if I can get a conviction,
yeah,
sends a message to the child.
Yeah.
The jury believes you.
Yeah.
You are believed.
Yeah.
And it just makes sure to take that offender away from that child. So in many ways, that was kind of the dual motivation,
yeah,
for these kids, is that process not just says them, I believe you, but it says that I will make sure others believe you.
Yeah. And did it?
Did it what?
Help the kids that way?
I don't think so.
Yeah. But we'll get to that though, right?
Yeah, we'll get to that.
All right.
We'll talk about my kids. I call my kids. So then...
Going through your faith crisis while this
going
is going
through my
on.
Faith crisis, yeah. Yeah. And that, I don't really connect the two at all, because one was, it was very separate. Although at the same time that was happening, as I was going through my faith crisis, a number of cases started coming in that were LDS specific. And that's when I first started seeing the issues with policies. And, you know, not just issues with, so the first thing I saw is there's a real problem in the Mormon church as it relates to offenders. There is a greater number of, from my observation, offenders that were coming from the Mormon community than were coming from any other community. And that was troubling.
Mm.
And I didn't really understand it and you know, tried to come up with reasons why or whatever, but...
When you, like, pre-faith crisis, when you would see something like that, would you feel any kind of affinity towards a Mormon?
No, and you'd see, in fact, the opposite.
Yeah.
Is it was almost like that is an aggravating factor.
Yeah.
Because you know better.
Yeah, you should know better. You should be held
to
a higher standard. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
It, very much. A lot of the other Mormon prosecutors would kind of, you know, that's a reputation that happens a lot, and I've seen that firsthand. But yeah, no, it was, and again, that goes to the indoctrination. My first mentor, she handled a couple bishop-specific cases, and in fact was handling one when I was kind of, you know, working for her. And so very quickly I learned, okay, the church has problems with molestation, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I knew that. I was really able to separate, okay, there's, you know, people do bad things, but it was definitely, I was definitely indoctrinated in that prosecutor mentality that religious institutions equal problems with sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't completely affect the you know, the faith crisis. It wasn't tied to that, but it gave me the strongest reasoning that I could tell people, right? Didn't have to go to Joseph Smith, Book of Mormon, all these things. What I could say is, look, man, just not going to support an institution that, you know. So that was happening as well. And my faith crisis happens, and these cases that kind of, where these guys are using the, you know, lessons of polygamy and the temple and all these religious themes to perpetuate abuse.
Mm. And how exactly? I mean, how does a religious theme perpetuate abuse?
Yeah. So, a couple instances that would come up is that the father would introduce the concept of polygamy as being a necessary thing, and that would that happened a couple different times to some victims. But then you'd also get offenders that would talk sexually and then start talking religiously, and that impact that what I saw that was doing, it was the religiosity like that would keep them quiet.
And that would be like a grooming behavior, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it would be, that's more of a concealment behavior where they're trying to get them to be quiet, make them feel shame. So you're like, hey, here's this sex stuff. And then you start talking about, you know, some religious stuff. And this is kind of a reminder to be quiet. You're involved in this too. It's not just me. So it's a form of shared responsibility in causing the child to feel responsible for the actions, right? Kind of reinforcing that. The other things you'd see is, they'd talk about, one guy would talk about how he would do everything but sex, but penile vaginal sex, I should say, because then she'd still be worthy to go through the temple.
Oh, well, that's kind.
Yeah.
That's good for him. Consideration. Yeah, yeah. That's nice. That's nice of him.
And so I saw these guys, and in some cases women, used worthiness as a tool in the abuse. Primarily, that's in the concealment phase, but you'd also get, starting by talking about chastity kind of things as a way of broaching that topic. And then using that as either, trying to be educational so you'd see that a lot as well. But usually they'd use the religiosity to keep the kid quiet, right? So I saw that a lot, and it was frustrating. But again, didn't really apply to my faith crisis at all. But I leave the church completely, and my religion was my job. And I said that. I used to tell people that all the time. This is my religion, and I really approached it with zeal, where I developed a reputation of being, very aggressive and, someone who really takes up for kids and isn't afraid to take challenging cases to trial. And me and some other trial partners that I had and some other attorneys, we started working these challenging cases up, taking small pieces of evidence, less evidence than other people were willing to charge and willing to go to trial on, because we understood what the story was telling. That is, when the counterintuitive stuff, what that explains. And one of the things that I was taught by one of my supervisors, or one of the trainees I had, that just really stuck with me, and it was, you can convict solely on the word of a child with the right tools. And I loved that. And I use that over and over again, especially when I'm picking a jury. And I say, is there anyone here who believes that you can't convict on the word of a child? And then you'd have a discussion about that. You'd get people, well, I can't. Tell me why. Well, kids make things up all the time. Okay, let's talk about that. What types of things do kids make up? Well, I mean, they talk about, being a princess, or they talk about playing cowboy. They'd come up with some beer and say, okay, is that... does that mean that you can't believe that child? And often what the technique is to say, is there anyone who holds a different opinion? And inevitably you have a parent, a teacher, somebody with a little training to say, oh, no, that's, yes, kids make things up, but they know what reality is, and then you start talking about age development and the difference in that. And you say, okay, what about lying? Do kids lie? Yes, kids lie. All kids lie, right? We just can't believe kids because they lie. Okay, let's talk about that. What do kids lie about? Kids lie to avoid getting in trouble. Kids lie, and they start highlighting the motivations that are there. And that's what I wanted, because I'm not educating the jury. The jury is educating themselves.
Yeah.
Right? So now when I have a kid that comes up and has absolutely no incentive to lie, but even more than that, they have a disincentive to tell that this guy was abusing them.
Right.
I don't have to say it. The jury has already made my argument for them.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that process of it. Is it's an art to select a jury. It's very, very challenging. And again, I became very good at it with some good training and some good mentors. Became very good at it, especially in sex cases, to advance these things. Another one I loved. Okay, kids believe things that aren't true. Okay, like what? Santa Claus. Fantastic. I'm so happy you chose that as an example. Let's talk about Santa Claus. Why do kids believe in Santa Claus? Well, all their parents tell them it's real. Keep going. What else? Well, then one day they say Santa's coming and there aren't presents under the tree. And then the next day there are presents under the tree and the cookie's been eaten. Mm. And there's all these signs. So we deceive children by people that they love and that they trust tell them a thing, and then we give them the evidence to support that. Is that a child believing that, or is it something else, right? So, yeah, that's right. Here's the other thing. Generally, do kids come to their own conclusions about Santa Claus, or are they told? Well, both. Okay, let's go with both. What about those instances when children come to their own conclusions about it? How does that happen? They know what the real world looks like. They get to a point in an age where they understand the real world. And they know that it doesn't make sense that one night, they start breaking it down, right? So kids are very good at interpreting their world. And so we explain that in Voir Dire, and then you get experts that come in and explain that and explain how children behave. And then you have experts come in to talk about memory and to talk about all these things. And so I really enjoyed that process because it was very intuitive, but it was also very, I'll say scientific or forensic, maybe even a better word, is I loved explaining how the real world works to juries because I felt like it was really easy to do once you understood it. And so I loved doing that. I loved trials like that that were challenging, and I've yet to lose a sex case even as a defense attorney. Hmm. We'll get there in a minute. Hmm. But yeah, I haven't lost, and I comfortably.
How many do you have to win before you get the set of steak knives? I don't remember. I remember that was in.
I think I was one shy or something. Yeah,
a few good men, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, but I figured that was my calling. That's what I do for the rest of my career. And then there was an election, and a new county attorney came in, and they wanted me to. Do real crimes, not wallow away in this banal sex crimes world, but go handle homicide cases, death penalty cases. And so I did that. And soon after that, I left prosecution because of some real issues that I had with the elected official, some issues he had with me. Turns out I'm not a very good yes man.
Mm.
So I asserted myself on certain things, and he felt challenged a number of times. And I'll be honest, this is my interpretation, because at some point I had a conversation. He called me into his office and he said, I'm the elected official. I don't have to tell you any reason why. You're going to need to give me your notice.
Ooh.
Out of the blue.
Yeah.
No idea. He wouldn't tell me why. So, I was excommunicated from my tribe.
Yeah,
because it really was. I mean, it was. I had been so sufficiently indoctrinated and bought into everything that they had sold about the law enforcement being mostly correct. Almost always correct. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The rightness of our position. What scumbags defense attorneys were. That was something that is just hammered, right? Every defense attorney is a piece of shit liar, right? And I used to articulate that. And then I got to the point where I've got to survive. The last thing I want to do is do defense, because that's not my calling. And the last thing beyond that I'd want to do is defend these piece of shit sex offenders, right? That was the idea. That was the concept, right, back then. But I started doing defense work. Leaving prosecution,
And I think it's important that you were kind of forced from it.
Yeah.
Like if you hadn't have had that elected, what was he?
The county attorney.
The county attorney fire you, you'd still be there, still be doing it.
Yeah, I think I would be.
Yeah.
I mean, I would, yeah.
And when you look on it now, are you grateful?
Oh, my gosh. It's beyond that. It was a necessary step for not just personal growth, but enlightenment.
Yeah.
It really, really was. So I started doing defense. And as part of that, necessarily.
We're going to have to dig into that a little bit more later, but I don't want to derail you.
Huh? Which part?
I don't know, whichever part you want to talk about.
What do you want to flesh out?
Huh? Because I had my situation this last summer where I lost this job that I was in for 13 years, in very complacent in this job, and scared shitless when I didn't have anything to do, you know, and like, what am I gonna? But now I look back on it as like absolutely the best thing that happened, because it knocked me out of that complacency. A couple of days ago, I was driving home from California, and I stayed with Brady Bloom. You remember Billy from 4C?
Yeah,
we're gonna bring him back on Infants on Thrones and have a conversation with him.
I like him a lot.
He's a stud.
Yeah.
And he's like ahead of the game, where he's recognizing the complacency in the job that he's in and thinking, you know what, I've got passions. I want to pursue my passion. So he's kind of going for that voluntarily, where I feel like me, and I think what you're saying is you, kind of got forced into figuring that out afterwards, which I don't know, is something that I wouldn't have ever wished upon myself. And I'm just so glad.
Yeah. Well, the forcing, what it did is it forced me to maybe start engaging in things and in concepts that I wasn't really prepared to do. So there was a transition, especially when I first left, just a comfort level and all this. I did want to, you know, one of the things that was part of that prosecution piece, though, and this is really a tribute to the good people that supervised me and that I worked with. We very much, wanted to do it the right way. So I was taught, and I did kind of practice over disclosing things. You know, not hiding anything, not trying to play games. You know, some of the things that prosecutors are accused of doing dirty. I really felt strong, and I try to reflect. And did I cross a line? Did I do anything inappropriate? I don't think I did, because of how I was trained. It was very much, and this was inspiring to me, the Dragon Slayer guy that I talk about, right, that gave that story about slaying dragons. He was one that said, and there's some say that he used to say this, but not actually follow, not actually walk it out, but that wasn't my experience. But it was, when you have the truth, you don't have to be scared of anything. So there's no reason to hide evidence. There's no reason to be afraid of bad facts. That was the other thing.
Yeah.
Things that you think are bad facts aren't bad facts. They explain how the real world works.
Yeah.
And if you explain how the real world works, you win as a prosecutor, because you are dealing with what's true. And I really believe that.
Yeah.
And it was very empowering. So when I'd have a kid or have a witness that had a flaw, I'd be like, that's right, because you're a real person.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's like an important mindset that kind of led me out of the church too, because I'm like, okay, so Fawn Brody writes this book about Joseph Smith. If it's true, then it's not going to hurt it if the church is also true.
Yeah.
If it's false, I'll recognize it. I want to see what's out there. I'm going to pursue that, you know? So I did a lot of like searching into places that otherwise they would have said, don't do this.
Oh, right. Oh, that totally makes
for
sense.
For that same idea about, you know, truth is going to be truth.
Yeah.
It'll be consistent.
And that idea caused me to do things that other prosecutors and other attorneys weren't willing to do.
Mm.
And that is like, ask a question you have no idea the answer for.
Yeah.
Because I don't care what the answer is.
Yeah.
Because if it's someone that's going to tell the truth, even if it appears to be bad and it doesn't fit into what I think would be helpful, I can still explain it, and that's all I want to do.
And you're not afraid of it.
Mm-mm. And I never was.
Yeah.
And or if it's somebody who I think's lying, if they're lying, I think I'm gonna be able to demonstrate that they're lying, and it served me really well. So, but that was an important, something that was really important, because the worst thing I ever had to do as a prosecutor, and the hardest thing I ever had to do, and I did this often, was have a case that came in and know this happened. I believe this kid. But realizing that I didn't have the type of evidence that I needed in order to convict, because it wasn't enough to believe that it was true. It wasn't enough to even know that it was true based on my training experience. I had to be able to prove it was true to 12 people. And that was just a judgment call on my part. Mm-hmm. And the worst thing to do was to sit a victim down and sit their parents down in most cases, because usually we weren't at that point dealing with the kids directly, but and tell the parents, look, I believe this happened. And I'd say I know it happened. Mm-hmm. But what I know and what I prove can prove isn't the same thing. So we talk about things like standard proof, right? We talk about the Constitution. We talk about rules of evidence. And this is why this would happen. One of the worst things in the world, and this happened too often, is to say, I can't charge your case because this cop either didn't do a thorough investigation or screwed something up. And in some cases, they screwed it up factually. That'd be these couple detectives who just botched every sex case that I'd ever seen. They'd get a report, they'd go up, knock on the offender's door, be like, hey, kid accused you of touching him, did you do it? Nope, can't prove it. And then they'd submit it to me. Meanwhile, I see what the kids described, and I see what they went through and kind of what's happening, and just a little bit more investigation could have fleshed that out and built what I call building a wall of evidence around the kid. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen. Or even sometimes even worse, you got the guy, he confesses, but that confession was obtained illegally, right? Violated some constitution. Now, many prosecutors would say, well, let's fight tooth and nail to still get it in, right? And if there was a legal basis to argue that, I would. But too many cases, I had to make that decision of, yes, this happened, but your cause is just. I can do nothing for you. Mm. One thing that I was doing a lot of is bringing old cases that were previously turned down by other prosecutors and reviewing them and seeing if I could prosecute them again. And I did it a few times that I was very proud of. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I would often say in those cases is, you know, at sentencing, if I got a conviction, I think I did in all those cases, was, look, the system has failed this victim. Law enforcement failed this victim. This prosecutor 10 years ago failed this victim, right? And then in one case, I remember I had done something just a little wrong that it affected something. And I came up and said, I have failed this victim. Her mother has failed this victim. All these people in this child's life are consistent. The only consistent thing in this child's life is that the adults in her life are failing her. Mm. And I saw that over and over and over again. And as soul-crushing as it was to deal with the trauma that I had to deal with when I got the guy, there was another level of trauma seeing how frequently these kids were failed by law enforcement, and by prosecutor offices, and by judges, and by the system at large. And it happened over and over and over again. But still, I was there to be able to work in the system, to be able to be a voice and be able to get some quote-unquote justice, whatever that meant. And what that meant was he goes away to prison for a long, long time. So that's an important piece, because when I became a defense attorney, I could still latch on to that commitment to the Constitution and the commitment to fairness and due process. So it was very, very easy for me to challenge the work that police did and to challenge the work that other professionals did in investigating the case. I got a case, a nasty case, that came in, and I ended up doing a trial. And there were multiple victims involved. There's six different victims of this one dude. And it was horrible because the cops did a horrible job. And they gave me all the tools to be able to point that out. And when I got that case, I struggled a bit. You know, do I do this? And I decided, of course I do it. Because this is the only way that I have now to protect these victims. Not just these victims, but victims at large. Because this system failed these victims. And as I went through my opening statement, I never touched the victims. I never called them liars. I never said you can't believe them. What I said is, this police agency failed these victims and failed you. Because it's the law enforcement's job to make your job, that is the jury's job, easier. Mm. It's not only, they not only have an obligation to the victims, but they have an obligation to the defendant. And so I hammered that through opening and through the trial. And not just as a rhetorical argument, I felt it. I meant it. I believed it. It was true. And I had so much fire for this one particular detective. By the way, this is a detective who I had worked with as a prosecutor for years, and I really despised him. And I despised him because he messed up so many cases. So in many ways, this case that I was the defense attorney on was a case study in all those failed victims that I had seen over the course of the last, you know, the 8 years prior to that, that this detective had failed. And so when I was saying this, it wasn't just an argument. I was talking to him. And I made the trial about him. Mm. And as they were putting the defendant on trial, I put the police on trial. I had to cross-examine a victim in that case, a teenage girl. And I crossed her, got done, I think it was fair. We went back in chambers and we're talking about some scheduling things, and the judge at the time, who was a former defense attorney, said, it was the proudest moment of my life, Glenn, I'll be honest. He said, Matt, I have never seen a more deadly cross-examination, but I've never seen a more gentle treatment of a victim on the stand.
Yeah.
And I said, Judge, because I know these cases, I know kids, there's no need to cause trauma to these kids in order to demonstrate that they've been failed. And he just kind of shook his head. And that was what I was going for, is somehow threading the needle of being extremely effective for my client, mm-hmm. and in advancing what these guys, that is the cops, did wrong, while not causing unnecessary trauma to the victim. In fact, as the prosecutor's doing his direct examination of the victim, I'm getting pissed.
Yeah.
Because he didn't have quite the same training I did as it relates to talking to victims, and he's just kind of fumbling through and making it awkward for her. And I'm just, you know, the trainer in me, the old prosecutor in me, is just getting worked up as he's not making it easier on her. And then I come in and I hit a couple points very softly. Sit down. Yeah, man, it was. So seeing that system is just frustrating. And here's, yeah, anyway. So that really helped me kind of crystallize my approach, you know, working as a defense attorney. And
how many years have you been doing that now?
What,
three,
over
four?
Three, almost four.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've handled a fair number of sex cases. And I've gotten, I think, some what some people would see as a good result for the defendant. Mm-hmm. In that trial, by the way, when we got done, before another victim had to testify, I got a call from that prosecutor, and he made a plea offer that should have been made many, many, many months before. And it's a plea offer that I suggested many, many months before that should have happened without having to put that victim on the stand. But unfortunately, yeah. We had to go through the process of the trial for the prosecutor and the police officer to see that what I was telling them that what was going to happen was going to happen.
It must be really frustrating, because the concern that you have for the victim to have to put them through all of this stuff and to see that the only people that really benefit from it are the people that are running the system.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not like the system isn't really there for the victim.
Did you hear that crack come through? You don't have your earphones. You're cracking my neck right in the microphone.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, sorry, I derailed. Yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm just lopping you a softball.
Yeah. And I just totally derailed it.
Thanks, homie.
Yeah. Yeah, what was the question? The question, it must be really frustrating to recognize that the system doesn't support the victim. It's really for the benefit of the different parts that are maintaining the system.
Yes. And
it's all about system maintenance.
It is. And not and
Because of the rigidity, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be.
Well, it may have to be because the one thing that I also learned as a defense attorney was I was unique in that and this is again it goes back to my training, the people that I associated with, because we had kind of this sub-cult within a cult, right? We were the we perceived ourselves as these big dog trial attorneys taking challenging cases to trial, not being afraid to lose, you know, willing to take our shot. And then there was versus the 80%ers out there that take easy cases, cheap deal the challenging cases, right? It's not about the guy that should be gotten. It's about how strong the evidence are. And that dictates too often that dictates the result. Mm. And I took a completely opposite approach. And so one of the things that I also felt strongly about both as a prosecutor, and this really instructed a defense attorney, I was very cognizant of my power, and especially my power in sex crimes here in Arizona, where the consequences, the prison sentences are huge. I mean, we're talking multiple life sentences, right? And I felt very strongly that if we are ending these people's lives, and that's what we're doing, there was an obligation to do it right and to make sure that, you know, not just the Constitution was followed, but if you could get more evidence, you did, right? Don't leave anything back. And as a defense attorney, it became very easy to adopt that mindset and say, you know, it whether or not something happened really is irrelevant in the criminal justice system. It's whether or not something happened
and can be proven.
And can be proven with the right under the right structure, mm-hmm. under the right due process system. Mm. And as a defense attorney, I started seeing defendants are also taken advantage of, grossly taken advantage of by the system. And so that same system that was not protecting victims, it was those same techniques that were taking away people's lives, the power of the government, in a flawed system, and using, not using the best techniques, not, you know, and especially again with sex crimes, I felt, I did start feeling called to continue to point that out, and point out what could be done better. So I really did have the interests of my client, because I really felt strongly that if we're going to send them to prison for a long time, you dang well better do it right. And my job is to make sure you do it right. Mm-hmm. It sounds so cliche, right? Defense attorney, everybody's entitled to a defense, right? But nobody really believes it, because in the same breath they say, "But how do you defend these guys?"
Right.
Well, you just answered it. You can say it. You just don't believe it. I actually happen to believe it. And one of the reasons why I believe it, I think, is because I look at all my kids that I had to turn down cases. That doesn't mean that they weren't worthy victims. It didn't mean that it didn't happen. It meant that there really is a higher ideal, and that's to get them the right way. And so that was, it became very easy for me to do defense, and it is very easy for me to do defense, because the system, especially the system in sex crimes, has gotten worse and worse and worse. The level of expertise has gone down. The level of training has gone down. These people are not relying on evidence. They're relying instead on emotionality. Mm. The mere allegation is enough to convict now, they think, rather than you can convict on the word of a child. And let me explain to you why this child can be believed and should be believed. There's been a shift there, and I'm offended by it as a prosecutor. And I say that all the time to these prosecutors, is I do defense work now because your work and the law enforcement work in this case offends me as a prosecutor. Because I spent so much time and energy training law enforcement, training prosecutors to do it right. And as I've gone away and other people have gone away and there's been attrition because it's a burnout type job, the skill, the knowledge is just different. Hmm. So that was an interesting conversion away from the religion of prosecution to see it. Oh my gosh, there are flaws there. Just like there are flaws in the church, mm-hmm. and just like there might be issues here and there, I saw those issues laid bare when I saw the other side. I mean, I saw the issues when I was watching how the sausage would make, but then being on the other side and seeing how defendants' rights were abused and how, as a result of that, victims weren't protected. And that's the case not just in sex crimes, homicide cases, vehicular cases, all these things. It's not enough to say, well, all that matters is whether or not somebody done something. It just can't be enough. Not if we're going to take away people's lives and put them in prison for a long, 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 long time.
So I want to ask you about enlightenment now, Matt, because you mentioned that earlier. Mm-hmm.
And that's where we'll pick up for part two of Matt's PPI. Thanks for listening.
My name is none of your business. And I like to eat enchiladas while listening to Infants on Thrones. If you like what they're doing, you know them, iTunes, whatever. Give them money.
On Patreon.
With a donation or just say a prayer and love them. Love them like you've never loved nobody before. Because I said so. Anyone for the closing prayer?
It's a film called Infants on Thrones.